Dear listeners, this month Fotografiska Tallinn is celebrating its first birthday, and for this special occasion we are bringing you an extraordinary podcast episode with two beloved photographers, Vincent Peters and Jimmy Nelson. Their artwork was exhibited in Fotografiska Tallinn last year. Jimmy Nelson was part of our opening exhibitions, and Vincent Peters brought light to our dark and cold winter months. Two characters with two different styles, but at the same time, both capturing the most profound parts of human soul. The next hour belongs to these two fascinating storytellers. And although pretty much everyone in the world has practiced different mediums like Zoom, Hangouts, Meet, etc. in the past 2 months, then technology remains technology, and things happen. So please forgive us for the sound quality, and we hope you will enjoy this podcast.
Alan put this together to have a conversation of two photographers, which I thought was a great idea. So I'm going to pass it on to Jimmy, and we're just going to see where this is going to take us.
Yeah, an organic conversation. I love these. Hi, this is Jimmy Nelson. I'm speaking from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. This is a thrill and a privilege to have this conversation with you, Vincent. It's a conversation we've never had before. We've never actually met, although we know of one another via, which we'll sort of get into in the conversation.
We're zooming around each other.
Yeah, there are lots of sort of parallel universes going on. And I also had the privilege to exhibit in Fotografiska Stockholm and Tallinn last year, which was a very, very important part of my life, as I presume it was in yours.
Beautiful place. I mean, the space you get and the attention, you know, it's true. It's a true privilege today to have that level of just presentation, you know.
Yeah, I'm very much in love with them and the space. And yeah, and it was a real sort of high point of my life. And I was listening to your podcast you had with Fotografiska Tallinn a few days ago. Yeah, and I wanted to begin, and I'll be very Dutch and very direct and very honest. Although we hadn't met, I had actually judged you, and I'm going to be very honest, and I find this appalling that somebody of my experience, I'm still judging people. And I judged you by the pictures that you make. Once I'd listened to you for 1.5 hours, there was an extraordinary depth behind the pictures, which pleasantly surprised me and made me very excited about the conversation we're going to have today.
Well, thank you. You know, like I said, I think in general, it's true. It's I think the work I do lies more on the surface in many ways. And I think the work you do, you know, lies a lot in the substance and in the humanity. But I think what's so interesting that in the end, Jimmy, all of these are just expressions really of what we are, you know. These are just different metaphors of ourselves, and I think they're expressing our relationship to the world with this, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's it's a good sort of journey or discovery to go on in the next hour. Who are we?
Yeah.
As opposed to how we are perceived by the pictures that were made by somebody else. And I think that's a sort of an interesting... And before we carry on any further, we have a number of things in common, because I was listening to your podcast and you were talking about the Titanic. And my original name was Nielsen, Nielson. It was a Norwegian. And they were from a Norwegian shipping company who 4 generations ago ended up in Liverpool in the northern UK.
Okay.
And my great-great-aunt was on the Titanic, and she survived on one of the lifeboats, and she had a plaque of one of the Titanic lifeboats, which I think, if it still existed in the family today, would be worth, I don't know what it would be worth, but
would be worth a few pictures.
Somewhere down the line, it disappeared. But so we come from sort of a shipping heritage.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it's nice that you took the time to listen to it, you know.
No, I thought I was seriously impressed by your let's say your intellectual journey of trying to discover or understand aesthetic and beauty, and that's something that very much resonates with me.
Because I think in general, Jimmy, the most obvious is always the least obvious in many ways, because it's the most unconscious. And I think the interesting part about photography, whatever you do with it, and if it may be just a person, you know, even people just shooting the sunset with an iPhone, there is always a revelation of needs, of longings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you, I think, I don't know how it is for you, But if you walk through Fotografiska and you see your own work on these walls, and, you know, I'm always thinking to myself, why do I take these pictures? Where does this come from? Because the process, at least for me, I think there is a very, there is an unconscious meeting a conscious. There is really a kind of a hidden inner voice that you don't really listen to. And suddenly that it, you know, you kind of like, you have it in front of you. And I think you, there is a very strong journey of self-discovery. And I think it's kind of, I mean, I think when photography is so obsessive today, you know, where everybody suddenly is a photographer, I think that self-discovering process of looking at something, your relationship to the world with something as abstract is very visual in photography. I mean, the reason why you go out there, why you chose these people, you know, it, I'm sure there's a deep sense in yourself of something that, that you're missing. And there's obviously something in the world that I'm creating, that I'm missing, you know?
Totally. I have a quote here in front of me, and I have a love of photography. It's an obsession with photography, or perhaps it's the spiritual process of photography. And there's a quote I have here from Ansel Adams, and I'm sure most people who are listening who are vaguely interested in photography know who he is, so I'm not going to explain. It says, Adams described the camera as an instrument of love and revelation. He believed that a great photograph is full of expression, of what one feels about being photographed, and is thereby a true expression of what one feels in the deepest sense about life and its in its entirety. He advised his students to be patient, to only record the moment that moves the heart, and to anticipate the emotional response for the photographs long before the triggering of the shutter. To me, this defines the art of photography. And I think you also discuss in your podcast your, I think you described it as a fear for the future of photography. And I kind of see it in the opposite. I'm kind of thrilled that there are 3.5 billion smartphones on the in the world, because I believe finally there's one language that we can all use, one language that we can all communicate with. And it's the mission that, of the likes of you and me who've made it into our profession for quite a number of years, to inspire these 3.5 billion potential photographers, not just to press the button, but to go on the bigger journey of discovering who they are and what they want to transmit through the medium of taking the picture.
No, I completely agree. I think that I agree with you completely on the process of photography, but I think what is changing so much right now is the process of the priorities of the photographs, you know, because I think there's so much, you know, it's the technicality of it seems to be so important. Or to a certain point, it's even the photograph itself, what's on it, the content that's so important. But I think that is just really, really at the end of the line, you know. And I think to go back to Ansel Adams, everything that's in a photograph is a procedure. And I think the picture of it, it's kind of like the final end of it for us. And then it starts living on in other people. You know, when you look at your pictures, then you stimulate and you kind of inspire the imagination of other people. But I think for yourself, it's obviously because it must be such a journey to get there and to talk to the people and to get through this whole process. But when you see your picture on the wall, that there's so much that happened before, but even I think mentally for yourself, emotionally. So what I'm trying to always, what I think it's important to remember that the picture is all the way at the end of the procedure. You know, that's the cake you pull out of the oven, you know, but there's apples been growing for trees for a long time.
I love the way you use the analogy of a cake, and I'm obviously continually using metaphors to describe my process and what I feel. And I had a large presentation a number of months ago to a whole group of teenagers who sort of challenged me quite aggressively and patronizingly. And they said, why, and I'm now using a 10-8 camera on plate film, and they said, why are you making your life so extremely complicated by only giving yourself the opportunity to make that one picture? And I sort of looked at them dumbfounded, tried to explain it. And they sort of, they're these big eyes sort of, And then I said, okay, what matters to you? And I sort of inverted it. And the average age was about 16 or 17. And one kid stood up, and he was quite cheeky, and he said, I want to kiss. It's all about who I'm going to kiss tomorrow. That's the biggest priority. And obviously the 2,000 kids burst out laughing. And I said, okay, well, this is really good. Let's take it and put it in the context of a kiss. Okay, tomorrow I'm going to give you two options. And suddenly the kids all lit up and looked at me. The first option is when you go into that school square outside, you can kiss everybody straight away. There's no rejection. There's no choice. There's nothing. Whatever you want, you get it instantaneously. And there was this big cheer across the hall. It was quite fun. And I said, but there is another option. It's the option I'm going to take. And that option is you're allowed one kiss for 1 second on the last second of the last minute of the last day at the end of the week. Which option would you choose? And they said, again, are you stupid? Are you that old? They literally shouted. And I said, yeah, I'm going to go. And he said, of course we're going to choose for option one. And there was this big cheer. It's a free-for-all. And I said, well, I go for option two because I'm not interested in the kiss.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the journey. I'm interested in the hunt. I'm interested in the seduction. I'm interested in the failure, the rejection, the focus. And then taking it into the context of baking, you were talking about a bake. We, on the journeys we go on, we're creating this colossal cake of 10 layers of sponge and cream and honey and jam. The pitcher is a small little shiny cherry that sits on top. The pitcher is what was hanging in Fotografiska. But the cake underneath, that's the process. That's what you sit in. That's what you wallow in. That's what you are seduced by. That's what you taste. And that is the thrill I find in the positions we're in, which is a very privileged position at our age to have a profession as a photographer, to enthuse these 3.5 billion photographers in the world to go on that journey, to go on that journey of connection.
But how does it make you feel? I guess that was that's always, because, you know, within what you're describing and within what you're saying, there is so much of an act of consumption. And I think it's true if you have 3.5 billion photographers, and you have all these cherries and you have all these artificial, I guess, to stay with your metaphor, Jimmy, we have so much artificial flavors today. And they taste good.
Okay.
But it's not a real cherry. It's just, but when people, you know, it has all the extra sugar and it looks super red and, you know, it has all these kind of like, put some vanilla on top.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You're thinking, growing an apple on a tree until that apple made it onto your apple cake. You know, it took so long.
Okay.
And it's been through so many processes and procedures. It's been through sunny and rainy days.
Yeah.
And I think that is really, and when people just consume it for the quick pleasure of a taste, yes, at least they had it. But I think when that's the question is, when you walk through Fotografiska and you have all these apples on the cake and you see people tasting it and surviving and moving on to the next. But sometimes you're thinking, do you know how difficult it was to get there? Do you know how like naked and embarrassed it is to have your pictures on the walls, you know? But I think that's what it takes. I think you need to be embarrassed about your pictures to make them personal enough.
But that's the real journey. That's the real process, that internal personal struggle, because nobody will ever understand what you went through. Nobody will ever understand what I went to. Having those images hang on the walls of Fotografiska is purely a way to sustain that struggle, personal struggle, to sustain that search, which is never ending. There is no end to it. And that's the thrill, the depths of discovery one has to go through. And you talked about it also in your podcast. It's a struggle. And without that struggle, but that struggle is the thrill. That struggle is the hunt, so that struggle is the search. And the more complicated it is, the more one... And I also love this struggle, as we were discussing, 3.5 billion photographers. How does one sustain, how does one create a platform whereby one's cherry, your cherry, my little cherry, has the momentum to be seen above the other cherries? And that was also... And to get into that position is almost impossible. But the thrill of it, and you also talked about a number of other photographers who you admired, and I think you mentioned Lindberg and Ritz, how they focused on one style, one theme, one context, and that's what made them great. to keep that focus, to keep that style, to keep that discipline, to keep that belief,
yeah,
is the biggest journey and the biggest thrill.
But you know what's interesting, Jimmy, is what, like, look, if you look at it, every picture talks. And it talks to you. It talks to yourself. I'm mm-hmm. sure you're looking at your images. Mm-hmm. You're primarily really speaking to yourself. And when you talk about the journey and the struggle, I think, you know, you can also see that there is, you know, it's such an effort. It's such a fight to get a good shot. I think people sometimes underestimate how difficult it is. But you keep doing it. And I'm thinking there is something so unresolved, so unfinished in us, you know?
I think that's the case in all of us. I mean, for me, it's very, very clear why I do what I do. It is very much a therapy. It's having had an extreme physical and emotional disconnection as a child between the ages of 7 and 9, to the extent that I hated everything about myself, to the extent that I essentially didn't want to live. But I decided to find a passage, a process, to find a reason for me to be here. And to find a purpose.
But see, that's what's so interesting, yeah, because I think exactly when you create a world, and I think we both clearly creating worlds, mm-hmm. even though they're so different apart, and we're using elements to create this world, but this world also projects a desire and a longing of a world that we like to have. And I think what's mm-hmm. one of the few, like, really connections between our world is that you could say they're partly nostalgic or sentimental. And I think going back to what you just said, I think a good explanation, a good kind of like view on nostalgia in the widest range is that you're missing something that you never had. Kind of like an emptiness there. And I think when you want to understand a photographer and you see what he's creating, you always have to see that this creation stems out of what you call a struggle or a desire to build something he never had, recreating maybe some emotional sense. Because I think if you say that nostalgia is missing something you never had, you could say that sentimentality, and I think that's also something that you find in both of our pictures, is a feeling that you never felt.
Yeah,
maybe in that mm. purity of your world, you find something that you were always looking for, you know, because there's also mm-hmm. something idealistic and, mm-hmm. and closer to nature and mm-hmm. kind of, I think, in that mm-hmm. sense, connected, you know, just connected. I think that, you know, I think in your pictures, I see a lot of community. People are there mm-hmm. for each other, mm-hmm. which could also say maybe when you said you felt alone, you were missing that level of not being judged, just being around, you know. Sometimes your pictures remind me a bit of Terrence Malick's movies. But I think this is a very, if you identify that feeling that there is something in the world you create because you don't know another way of feeling it, you try to connect with some longing, mm-hmm. you know.
No, yeah.
That comes from a truthful place. It's always a bit melancholic, but at least you're giving it to other people. You have the capacity of taking them to that place. Now, I don't think it matters what they feel when they're there, you know? Like, for example, you take me to an island, and I think literally almost you do. And I think then you say, oh my God, look at this guy, and I met this guy before and chased this food. But for me, it's a different experience. But you can take me to those places, but what I feel there, it would be completely up to me. But I feel something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that's what matters in communication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think the pictures we do, me in a very different sense, they're a bridge to a different place. And we can guide people across the bridge. But once they're there, we leave them alone. It's like you take people mm-hmm. with you to the jungle. But once you're there, you just let them run. You know, you cannot tell them how to like it or dislike it. Or how to
it. Yeah, you were talking in your podcast about beauty. And about how everything changed in 1912, and anything that was beautiful was regarded as kitsch.
I
have an obsession with beauty. I have an obsession with light. I have an obsession with an aesthetic, which I'm trying to communicate at the same time as comprehend.
Yeah.
And it is looking for a salvation of everything that I was taken away from me as a child, which I've tried to reconnect to. And you also talked about it being sentimentalism, a longing, a needing to be held, a feeling, essentially love. I don't in any way contradict the fact that the images I'm making are a connection with others to try and be loved. So the process of submitting, in many ways sacrificing myself physically, mentally, and emotionally in the process of communicating, is to lay one's soul bare, to be, we say in Dutch, ontarmed, to be gathered up, to be hugged, to say you belong. We see you for who you are. We don't judge you for the way you look, what you feel, or where you're from, but we see the essence of your soul. So
essentially, the interesting part is that we're both accepting the pain of failure for it and the pain of rejection. You know,
yeah, but
I think this is the way to get where we need to be.
But that's thrilling, absolutely thrilling. I find it so exciting. Yeah. And in a way, I've had some rather interesting experiences in my last 52 years, and some of them I don't think other people would have sort of come out of healthily. And I've now begun to realize that perhaps choose this path, having had quite an unusual early childhood. The thrill of the complicated, the thrill of the adventure, the thrill of the unknown is very much sort of part of a sort of a repetitive strain in my life. And it's obviously something I obviously need.
I think the interesting part really is, you know, I mean, I'm sure you get those questions too, but I get a lot of questions about the explanations of beauty or some sort of definition, of beauty, you know. And I think, you know, interesting is when I had the opening show at Stockholm, there was a woman coming to me, and you know, the Swedish people, they're a little reserved and very
bit dry. You
know? And she came to me and she was like, well, what do you think about, why is your pictures are very beautiful. And I sensed the criticism in it. And she was a bit like, you know, she was like, so why do you think everything needs to be beautiful that you're photographing? But I also realized in that conversation or with that remark, because I get this sometimes and I keep thinking about it, that beauty as itself is rather a state of, like, just what you described, of being held. I don't think it's an aesthetic standard. I think it's being, feeling part of something, the beauty of a moment where you're with friends, where they're laughing, maybe the beauty of being in nature. You feel small and you feel you're part of something bigger. And I think also maybe the strong rejection you have today of beauty as being something rather meaningless and a little bit superficial is also because a lot of people rejecting that sense of beauty because they feel, if I cannot be a part of it, I don't want it to be there, you know?
But I think it's very profound what you're also saying, but it's not the exterior, it's the interior. You asked me what I felt when I go in this process of making. The way I connect, the way I resonate, it's Ansel Adams has another amazing quote. I love it. He says the negative are like the creating the notes, the script. The print is the production. The more notes, the more instruments, the more complicated, the bigger the choir, the more the layers, the more complicated it is to align all those sounds in our case, the light and the subject. Mm. When it aligns, the soul and the mind and the heart sing. I find it extremely thrilling looking for that beauty that you want to feel. And it's the image, again, is the cherry on the cake that hangs on the wall, but it's what you feel, connecting to that beauty, connecting to that power of enabling oneself to feel beautiful. But it's an internal feeling, it's not an external feeling. And weirdly, everybody perceives photography to be this external process of, as you said, judgment, all 3.5 billion of us making pictures. But what people have got to connect to is how it makes you feel inside. That's what it's all about. And what you make and why you make it, it doesn't matter. But if you indulge in that internally, it can be outrageously fulfilling.
But I mean, honestly, if we look at it like this, we can almost see that the success of photography, it's also, and it kind of like goes hand in hand with industrialization. And it's also rather, testimonials of loneliness, because the more isolated, the more we're leaving the village in a way, you know, those people you're photographing, they're not used to being photographed. They probably don't photograph each other because they have a stronger sense of community. The more industrialized a nation becomes, the more it has the need to photograph things or, as we would say, you know, escape your inner prison with postcards you're sending from your own vision. You know, that you said, look, I'm here. I've been to this place. I experienced happiness with these people. I had friends. I had great food, you know. Mm-hmm. It almost seems to be the need to confirm your existence through that.
Yeah,
I think it really seems to go hand in hand with industrialization.
Yeah, I am often, we've started a charity next to the project where I return to most of the people I photographed, and we're sort of reinvesting in the communities. And the first stage of that is returning with the work I've made. And you come with the books and the pictures. And I'm always naively enthusiastic as I arrive and present it. And there's always this sort of very sort of almost bored. Obviously, I'm remembered, which is great. And they remember my name. And often I'm sort of given a bit of an enthusiastic welcome. And then you present the work and there's this sort of almost non-bored look. And as if they were to say, and what do you expect us to say? And then, you know, you want an opinion. Then they said, but we don't really have an opinion because we're not really interested, which I always find very confusing. I said, but, you know, look at these pictures. Look at these pictures of yourselves. Look at these pictures of others. And they go, but we don't have any reference of recording. We don't use mirrors. But we are very busy with how we look, but we connect to that with how we feel. It's not an external, it's a community. So we gather together, and it's not only how you feel, you're told how you feel, you're told how you dress, you're dressed very much in balance with the natural environment that you live in. And all the rituals and the symbols of it are connected to the nature you live in and around, and all the rituals and all the celebrations are part of that. So it's a process of feeling that's internal, not external, and with the community. And I find that wonderful. And you sort of get into it. And they say, well, it's fine that you see us and perceive us in this way. And, you know, we enjoy the process and we enjoy having you. But come with us and try and connect with the present. What do you feel at this particular moment in time? And that's what I find so alluring, having been disconnected from my validity, my beauty, my worth. And slowly, after many, many years, beginning to understand the real power.
Did you, you know, there's a couple of things that make me think about. One thing, I think a photograph also is always an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And an opinion, I think, in general, I think we're living at a time where we need to make everything available, but at the same time, everything is a matter of opinion. There's an interesting book from a guy called Charles Taylor. I don't know if you're familiar with
him. No. And I'm going to write it down.
He wrote something about that. He says modernism, as what we're living in, is in itself a declaration of independency. Everything modernist, everything that we're living through, is disconnecting, protecting, and creating independence from nature. Like right now, you can control the color of the room. You can control the temperature. Mm-hmm. You can control the lighting. You got the windows to be closed. You know, everything around us. He said, for example, if you counter explain that in the medieval, you know, people thought, for example, that looks could give you harm. You know, like things happen from the sky. You know, like if somebody did something bad, he would be condemned. So you see the self, what you are, was more permeable. It was softer to the environment. It could have been influenced. And I think what everything we're creating in the modernism is we try to create like a plastic wall, something that is very well protected from the environment, from the outside. But at the same time, it isolates us. And I think today we're more and more confronted with the deficits and photography. I mean, you know, to give you another example, then photography is something stupid, whatever comes to mind. But look, for example, I mean, yeah, it could be an Ayurveda kind of like, you know, class in India. It could be yoga, but it could be something as simple as reading a horoscope. I think you can see that the success of a horoscope is also because I think people have such a need still to be connected to the environment, to be connected to the forces, to what's surrounding you, like the stars influencing me and my life. You know, nature, like I'm allergic against gluten. The environment has an impact on me. But in a funny way, everything we do is to distance ourselves from our environment, to only deal with a deficit that we feel isolated from it. And I think, and then there is the need, also something that I see in photographs, then we have a need to reconnect with that environment that we spent 300 mm-hmm. years kind of like, you know, creating mm-hmm. a distance between us and that. Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, if you look at, this is a very good point to hand. If you look at what's happened worldwide in the last 3 months, to make this topical, I think, and this is with all due respect to the number of people who've died, in general, they tend to be elderly or unhealthy in all respects. No disrespect to them. The fear, what's happened, is that if you talk about control and modernism, the realization is that we're not in control at all.
Exactly.
And this complete delusion, and you talked about controlling lighting and heat and temperature and concrete.
Yeah.
And look at where it's brought us. Something is in the air, which we've created as human beings, that we can't control. It's not that a few people die. It's the fear and the realization from modern human beings that if we don't make radical changes, this is only going to go on and on and on. And we talk about being wealthy. And we talk about being, and look at where we've ended up. We've become modern-day rats living in 30 square meters, and we're not allowed out, and nobody's allowed in. That's been impoverished.
And I think the inability to deal with the connectivity we're having, because the interesting mm-hmm. part is what you're saying, rather than seeing the connectivity that something happens on a market in China or whatever, mm-hmm. and it affects your life in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. or my life in New York or Berlin or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, and rather than seeing it as something positive, it leaves us with fear, you know? Mm-hmm, we suddenly mm-hmm. becoming the victim mm-hmm. of this because we mm-hmm. never learned to be positive about connectivity, I think. And suddenly it's like, oh my God, you know, are you wearing a mask? Are you mm-hmm, having distance? Mm-hmm. Because you're like, no, like there is something we – like I think the interesting part about everything that happens right now is – it's in the air. We all breathing the same air. We all breathing what's out there. We breathing in what other people breathing out. What better metaphor could there be for an invisible, deep connectivity we having?
And then
it's, as you said, it's completely ridiculous to think that social distancing is going to disconnect us from each other and going to kind of protect us.
And look at what happened in the States. You know, I mean, that's... You know, and then the metaphor, I can't breathe. There's no surprise that's evolved into a whole new movement running parallel to COVID. And it's not just that that poor man who was murdered couldn't breathe or a race can't breathe. It's human beings can't breathe. That's why there's this whole...
There's so much in that metaphor of exactly what you're saying, of suddenly breathing becomes... like breathing somebody else's breath is a danger. Mm-hmm. He could be contaminated, you know?
Yeah. And so going back into photography and bringing it around back near to the beginning, I find it actually thrilling that the whole world's become a photographer. And it's a necessity and a role and an obsession of mine to... Okay, if you're going to use a camera, which you all have the right to do, study, investigate what you look, use it as a tool to better study yourself, study your surroundings, and not look at the end result, but use it as a passage to take you to feel and to connect in one case with the natural world in a different way.
What's the interesting part about this, and if you look at really early photography, I think what you do, Jimmy, is really much related to... The first instinct of photography is to get out in the world. And photography, in many ways, it defines what is the relationship we personally have to the world around us. How do we connect with it? You know, how do we like? And you know, it's true. Like for example, you know, there's it even right now. I think like what we said in the beginning, a picture. You recognize how you feel about the world.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain point, for example, what was interesting, like right now, talking about the corona again, you could really see, because it's so abstract, you couldn't see it, but you could define people's relationship to the world because there were the people that were really afraid, and there were the people that were very like, oh, what is this stuff? You know, look, come on, you know, like it's nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you could see that the relationship these people have to, there's an interesting guy called Adorno who said, if you want to know how you feel about the world, listen to the wind. Because when you wake up in the middle of the night in a storm and you feel there's a strong storm and maybe your window's shaking a bit. Are you afraid? Are you afraid that the window's going to break? Mm-hmm. Are you afraid that something happens to you? Or do you feel protected? Do you feel in the middle of nature? Do you feel, look, there's this world out there. Let me listen to it. There's a storm, you know. But the wind tells you about how you feel about life. And I think in many ways also, you know, the pictures you take will always kind of tell you that deep inside you have a basic connection with life that could be attractive or it could be repulsive, you know. You can be afraid. Like, you know, I'm sure when you talk to people about your pictures, often people say, but isn't that dangerous?
Yeah, continually. And I often answer, and this is the truth, walking around the streets of New York, Paris, or London, I'm in terror. And I have more examples to share, which I'm not going to, there's no need to go through them now. Take me into the depths of Papua New Guinea, where it's taken me 3 weeks to reach a community, where I'm so off-grid, you will never, ever, ever, ever find me again. Yeah. And if you dare to walk in, and I mean this metaphorically, naked, and bare your soul, put yourself on the ground, and put your hands up to the sky, and say, help.
Yeah.
I'm afraid. I'm lost.
Yeah.
And you get, again, gathered by these communities. And then you take them in this process of respect. It's a dance. It's a prayer using the camera. And it takes a long time to communicate. And then you involve the communities by using natural light and reflectors. And then you end up taking these very directed, subjective, romantic images of a group of eight heroes standing underneath a waterfall. If you manage to achieve that, it's a journey of a month. You make that one image, you end up, and it's weird. I've had occasions where we haven't been able to travel back to the village because it was too dark, because we were using the light right at the end of the day. And we fall asleep around a fire in the rocks underneath a waterfall. There's no bedding, there's no pillows, there's no food, there's no nothing. Okay. The sleep I have there is some of the deepest, safest sleep I've ever had in my life.
Interesting, huh?
Because you've submitted, and the community you've been working with, subsequently photographing, see you bearing your soul, see the passion that you have for them, and they protect you. And it's heaven on earth.
You're really confirming a sense of your attraction towards these places and towards life, your curiosity, you know, has so much to do with getting in there. And if you would have been on somehow had a different journey, if you would have been brought up, things would have walked in a different way.
It would have never taken me here.
And you know, obviously I don't think when I listen to you, it doesn't sound like that you feel in danger. You almost feel like you've been taken to a better place.
I'm not religious. I'm very spiritual, but I'm not religious. But it's taken me into an enlightened place. It's absolute. There's a lovely quote I've got here, sort of by Edward Steichen. Extraordinary photographer. Photography records the gamut of feelings written on the human face. The beauty of the earth and the skies that we've inherited, and the wealth and the confusion we as human beings have created. It's a major medium and force of explaining us to ourselves as humans. I love that.
Yeah, it's funny that you talk about this because, at the opening of, I heard Sean Penn told this story. It has to do with God, and I always think most people don't know what to do about it when you speak about it because it's so abstract. But I was kind of talking about this at the opening from my show, and it reminds me about it. So there is this couple has another newborn baby, and they're bringing it home from the hospital. And it's true, I'm sure you find parallels within this with the experiences you have. So they're bringing home this baby, and they have already a 4-year-old, and they want to show it to the 4-year-old, and he says, can I see it alone? And the parents get a bit wary because they heard about sibling jealousy. But why do you want to see it alone? He says, I can't tell you. And they get a little bit scared, and they said no, they might not think it's a good idea. And then a few weeks pass by, and the brother refused to see the baby. And they say, one day they sit in bed, and they say, look, obviously, there is an intercom, we can be right outside. Obviously, he needs you know, to get something off his chest. So I mm-hmm. think we shouldn't deprive him of that experience, you know. So they said, okay, you know, you can go and see your baby, kind of like, you know, sibling. And so they let him in, and then they rush to the intercom, and they listen to what happens. And then they feel his two steps, and then they hear the four-year-old saying to the baby, talk to me about God, because I start to forget everything. And I think, you know, if you look at that in a different way, it's not just the people you meet. In many ways, Jimmy, I think it's also what people expect you in a way from art in mm-hmm. general. Mm-hmm. They expect you to tell them something that is deeper, on a deeper layer, that they forgot about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I think when you're looking at images, yeah. the desire, or let's mm-hmm. say, what a photographer or what any artist mm-hmm. can provide, is reconnect you, even mm-hmm. like you reconnecting mm-hmm. to a certain point when you're sleeping by the waterfall, to a piece that you cannot find anywhere else, that mm-hmm. obviously maybe was taken away from you as a child, and mm-hmm. you're kind of like refinding. But I think a little bit like that baby, with a certain truthfulness, you can reconnect people to something that they're starting to forget. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean this as a religious experience, mm-hmm. just like you said it, but I mean it as a deeper experience to reach some tissue that has been overgrown, you know?
It's a beautiful story. I had an interesting conversation a few days ago, and probably like you, the last few months I've been based here in Amsterdam, which is actually a good thing. Rather than the external travel, it's been the internal travel. And my staff here, my colleagues said, you know, you've got to be a little bit more active on social media. And I met a young lady the other day, and she sort of sent me a communication, said, can I talk to you? And obviously there's time, so I made time. She was 18, from Chicago. And she sort of came on the screen with these big eyes. She went, oh my God, it's you. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, I'm really talking to Jimmy Nelson for live. And then she said, you're my hero. And she started crying. And
sweet.
And she was sitting there sort of hyperventilating, it's the real you, it's the real you. And I said, sweetie, calm down, calm down, calm down. And I said, take a deep breath. Now, what do you see at the end of the camera? And she said, I see Jimmy Nelson. I said, okay, no. Look beyond that. Let's deal with what you're looking at and what you're aspiring. And I said, the reality of what you see is a 50-year-old guy. Mm. So I don't think aesthetically I'm your hero. Also, the aspirations are not that, but what I represent is perhaps something heroic. Heroic, you aspire to feel yourself. So what you feel when you look at these images resonates with you. Exactly. I'm the communicator. I'm the passage that's reconnected you to that feeling. You project this idea of me being your hero to come and save you, and I never will, and you don't want something, the 50-year-old guy saving an 18-year-old girl. But the subject is the hero. And then persuading her in the beautiful conversation which we had, she was extremely smart, that perhaps she could become her own heroine. So again, that's bringing it back to the person, bringing it back to the internal, and obviously she wanted to be a photographer, and how she could use the camera to celebrate herself and reconnect with the journey that she was on. So it's a lovely conversation. I have a question I want to ask you. It's a bit of a personal question. When I was listening to your podcast earlier, you were talking about art, and you're obviously with your parents and the struggle. And then you referred it a lot to when you're working as a commercial photographer. You're an extremely good commercial photographer, and I know you know that, and everybody can see that. But your struggle with in assignments with, in Dutch you say, I'm losing my English, the opdrachtgever, the client. Is that struggle? This is what I was asking myself when I was listening. Is that a struggle that you need, or would you like to do without it? Because you can easily step out of it. And reflecting on that, I did that 10 years ago. I worked as a commercial photographer up until about 11 years ago. I didn't do high end. I was never anywhere near as good as you are in your portrait show, but I did sort of big advertising, cigarettes, airlines, and banks. And I was in this struggle. Nobody was ever happy. There were only ever complaints that with the onset of digital and Photoshop, there was this unending feeling of dissatisfaction on everybody's behalf. And one of the reasons I stopped it and basically went back down to ground zero and went back to my roots was this need to create for myself, not for others. Does that make sense? And the weird thing is now when I make a picture and I present it, there's never one in essence, negative opinion. It's just wow. If that's what you see, if that's what you see and feel, that's fine with us. And by comparison, in the past, 11 years ago, when I made a picture for somebody else, oh my goodness me, it was a sort of a nightmare because there was never any true satisfaction to it.
Well, I think it. I look at it this way. I think the job I do, and to a certain point, it's true, but I think most art was always based on commission because the artist had to live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think obviously the biggest commission of art in the world history is the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the restrictions, you know, of how do you paint a Maria and the child and the Virgin and, you know, everything was so refined. But still, you know, there's guys like, you know, Botticelli or, you know, I mean, you know, these guys were still capable, you know, or Raphael to paint exceptional pieces within that range. I think even if Mozart had to compose an opera or a symphony, it was probably commissioned by the King of Austria or somebody within that kind of like level of range, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you have to work. So I do think restrictions to a certain point are the exchange also for the privilege. They said, okay, listen, so the king commissions an opera, and you can use it, will be shown in the National Opera of Vienna, and it will be your music, but it will be under his law.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, back in the day, you probably know it couldn't be in German. It had to be Italian, to cater to certain...
Although Mozart tried to confront that.
And I think trying to get around that, that's where your creativity has been forced, you know? And I think it's true. It's always, you know, how do you deal with the system? How do you still keep it personal? How do you paint a Virgin Mary with a child and make it yours?
Okay, so,
but on the good thing is that people go to church under a specific perspective, you know, and they look at it with a very emotional aspiration. So you have a strong level to communicate, but you got to personalize it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And to stick to that, the interesting part is, you know, if for example, there is an interesting philosopher around the French Revolution called Anselm Feuerbach.
Mm-hmm.
And what he defined is that the saint in the Catholic kind of tradition is just what we are, but he's just a little bit better than we are. He can do those things that we don't do because our character is never as pure, you know? And if you, and he says, so the definition of the Catholic Church is just creating those people, they're just always a little better than you. And in a certain way, they make you feel maybe a little inferior, but also something to aspire to. Now, the interesting part is if you translate this into contemporary, you know, let's say, you know, fashion or celebrity culture, which is obviously another obsession besides photography today, you know, you will find that exactly that, but just happen on a different moral spectrum. But those celebrities who are, you know, when you work with them, you feel they are just communicators. They are just what we think we should be. Celebrities are not that different, Jimmy, really, from the people you're shooting. Because I think to a certain point, those people you shoot, they just seem to be a little bit purer than we are. They seem to be a little bit closer to nature. They seem to have something that we lost. And I think that's a strong communicator on your photography. The people I shoot, to a certain point, they seem to be slightly outranking us in attention, maybe in beauty, maybe in a successful living in the broadest term. They made it. They but if you strip all of this away, Jimmy, they've been loved, and that's what really is so striking and also so contradicting about a celebrity. When you look the struggle they have just to receive love, and you take Marilyn, you take whatever. A lot of people break down on it. But to a certain point, the people you shoot, they breathe love with nature, with each other. The ideas are very simple, but those celebrities, again, they are acting out as a part of ourselves and our personality that that we're longing to be, which brings us really back to photography, you know? And interpreting them in your way and saying, these are just like saints, necessary figures in your life. They provide guidance. You know, is an interesting subject to work on.
When
you interpret them, just like you interpret somehow, you know, the people you meet in Mongolia, mm-hmm. somehow you give them your version of it. We feel liberated.
It's interesting. Although we are similar, we're also very different in the work and the experiences we've had. And I've obviously never really had any interaction with celebrities. Although in more recent times, the celebrity culture seems to be attracted to what I'm doing because they find a value and perhaps a sort of a passage of salvation within it or with me or part of it. And you were referring in your podcast, which I listened to earlier, of a celebrity who at a very tender age of 10 became outrageously famous. And I think I know who you're talking about. And I've been speaking with her recently and she's connected with me because of this complete disconnection. And on one hand, you know, extreme celebrity status, but at the other hand, feeling utterly and totally lost and trying to find a place in the world and on the planet. Exactly. To feel a value, which I find absolutely fascinating. Yeah,
you know, it's a very common struggle, you mm-hmm. know? But the more authentic they're struggling, just like you and me, mm-hmm. Jimmy, it's the struggle that people identify mm-hmm. with, and it's the authenticity of that mm-hmm. woman you're speaking about, mm-hmm. you know, like she's struggling for all of us. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, she's nothing else than just, she's just a catharsis for like a metaphorical classic hero in a fairy tale that we need to compensate, to mm-hmm. relive and to mm-hmm. comprehend our own struggle.
But a bit interestingly, she shares this struggle, which is also sort of perpetuates her celebrity, which makes it even more yeah. of a contradiction. No.
Anything, and people say, "Oh, that's great."
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they mm-mm. but they work so hard for it, and then they're so captured by it. Mm. You know,
going back to the question a few minutes ago about that. So, as regards the future, and I think it's always interesting, that do you see yourself still working in the confines of an assignment? Because trying to sort of struggle, we go back again to find a signature that will make you distinguish yourself and stand out from other photographers within the confines of that assignment. Is that something you'll carry on? Or you also mentioned about stepping out of it, although you're worried about stepping out of it, and you referred to also a film director. And
Well, I think the problem is that we, you know, from the you know, I think there was an interesting and kind of like comfortable business model. Mm-hmm. It was created literally around the First World War. And Steichen, you mentioned, mm-hmm. Weston or mm-hmm. Man Ray. They're all more definitely, you know, Steichen a lot. They worked already within this business model, which was that, mm-hmm. you know, you develop a certain style. You work for magazines. Magazines mm-hmm. give you a certain freedom. They don't really pay you for mm-hmm. it, you know. But it's you use the magazine vehicle without really getting paid to promote your work, mm-hmm. and eventually then you know some advertiser comes to you and you do some advertising and then you have money to buy some mm-hmm. tea and do some more work, you know, and this very like basic business model, which kind of made you know Condé Nast, for example, or Harper's Bazaar, you know, like household names all over the world in the last what I say almost 100 years. Literally in the last 100 years, is disappearing right now through social mm-hmm. media, mm-hmm. you know, because people advertise in different ways and these magazines lose influence, power, and they lose simply money. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the possibility anymore. You know, remember when I mentioned, for example, a guy like, you know, Helmut Newton or Peter mm-hmm. Lindbergh, where most of their work that it's been books and museums or galleries today was actually befunded and
was commissioned
by yeah. magazines. Yeah, yeah. This is editorial work. I think what Peter Lindbergh, I couldn't think of a picture from Peter Lindbergh that was
just free work.
Taken on a mm-hmm. shoot of an editorial shooting, most mm-hmm. of the times probably for Italian Vogue or mm-hmm. for, you know, mm-hmm. like something like that. And, you know, I think, you know, even most of the, I think Newton was diverting a little bit to the left and the right, you know, definitely evident it. But the basic idea, they followed one very mm-hmm. strong structure that is disappearing. So, yes, mm-hmm. I think I'm definitely questioning myself also. As a vehicle, it seems less interesting. But mm-hmm. the part of fashion is that fashion is a very empty canvas. You know, mm-hmm. again, a little bit like a religious story. You can fill it with your own interpretations, and because the expectations for it are very rigid, you know, it you know, like for example, the aesthetic standard is very rigid. You mm-hmm. know, then again, you go back to Newton, you go back to most fashion photographers by slightly provoking or changing those aesthetic standards. You know, you can divine your own voice, mm-hmm. and that is slightly disappearing today. So,
it's
asking myself, and that's a good direction to go to.
Yeah, and it's a good discussion to have, because I think for the people who are listening, the majority of them are interested in photography or perhaps even in a photography career. And that was where my question originated from. I haven't had a photographic assignment for the last 8 years. Mm. So nobody's actually.
Hallelujah.
I gave up about 11 years ago and then decided, okay, well, I have to create my own assignment.
That's when you got more happy, right?
And strangely, yeah, well, I had to first give everything up, huh?
Yeah.
I had to first go down to the bottom, and I'm not going to indulge in... But go down to the... I had to give everything up, and I'm not going to list what I had to give up, and jump without a parachute into a very deep canyon and crash. But you are right. And when you jump and you go down right to the source, realizing I'm going to begin again. And then in a weird way, now, it's not about photography. It's about a story.
You know, actually, it's funny. Yeah. What you say is a very good description of the philosophy of Kierkegaard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's about, jumping without knowing where you land. It's mm-hmm. the fear of mm-hmm. letting go. You know, mm-hmm. and then you know that you find the faith by you confronting the worst fear of just really jumping into the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, fun fact at the side.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. I mean, look, you chose a very different road. It's true. My vehicle was always saying, I'm taking a person that you think you know, and I'm interpreting it in a different mm-hmm. way. I think the similarity between our work in that sense is that you take a particular part of the world that we think we know, that we idolize to a certain way, or that we're afraid mm-hmm. of, and you're confronting people with your vision of that part, you know? But I think, like I said, in both of us, they're sort of like nostalgic, idealistic versions. They're reflecting our own perspective, but the vehicles we chose, you know, if I do it with whatever, Monica Bellucci as kind of like an Italian mother in general, mm-hmm. you know, it's just that I'm still making my movie with her, you know, and that is, I guess, you know, like, look, like, you know, you see a Hitchcock movie or Woody Allen movie, but it's their movie, and you see the way they tell it to you, it's their story.
Yeah. What I think is also fun is the grass is always greener, and I sort of look at your work and I reflect and I think, oh no, you know, did I miss out on something when I see all the extraordinary people you've met and all the sumptuously beautiful women you've had the opportunity to light?
Again, don't forget the quality of the work is not what they are, is what you make people believe they represent. Mm-hmm, again, mm-hmm, then mm-hmm. you have the struggle of, do you feel held in the context of beauty,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think it's a little bit, look, when, you know, you as a portrait photographer, for example, you see that, you know, the struggle we all have, you know, the biggest struggle we all go through is how do we align with other people's vision of ourselves? Are mm-hmm. we really appealing to others the way, do other people see what we see when we look in the mirror?
Mm-hmm.
And that insecurity, that if you take a portrait, especially of the people you're working with, but the funny thing is, in a certain way, Jimmy, I'm so far at the other side of the spectrum. I'm shooting the most photographed people in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And you're shooting probably the least
people who've never been photographed.
World, you know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But the connection they're having with it may be mm-hmm. not as different, because what we both mm-hmm. do is we show these people a version of themselves they maybe not ask for.
Mm-hmm.
We show these people a side of themselves that they would never see otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And we confront them with a level of experience of themselves that mm-hmm. they may or may not want to engage mm-hmm. to, but it's very violently suddenly presented to them, you know? And the people I'm working with, it's all they are. They are famous. They've been photographed. Mm-hmm. They're meaningful for others. Mm-hmm. So their vision of themselves is very significant as a definition of their biography, mm-hmm. you know?
I think we're slowly coming up to an hour, and there are two questions I want to ask you, and I'll also ask them to myself, and I think they're relevant. And I presume you've been asked them before. When you talk about beauty, are you often asked, are you perpetuating the beauty myth?
Yeah, like I said, I think Look, I mean, it's true. I think something that would be interesting to talk about, Jimmy, you mentioned something before that called resonance. And mm-hmm. I think what is so striking about your work, it's the journey to the mystery. And I think in all these conversations, Jimmy, we're having, and in all these questions, people asking questions, we want to make answers. Why do we want to make answers? Because a strong force of let's say, modernism or postmodern capitalism, however you want to call it, is making world available. Mm-hmm. You're shooting people mm-hmm. that resisted to be available. You're shooting people who preserve the mystery. Everything we do right now in life, in this circle we are, Amsterdam, mm-hmm. New York, Paris, mm-hmm. wherever, we're living off making more world available, making resources available, mm-hmm. making it scientifically the deepest matter needs to be mm-hmm. understood. Everything needs to be understood scientifically. Mm-hmm. Economically, everything needs to be for sale. Mm-hmm. Let's say technically, every place needs to be reached. Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. Let him mm-hmm. go. You know, but I think the more things we made available, the more we destroy what really connects us to the world is the same thing that really connects us to each other. It's the mystery, mm-hmm. because you never really know the person in front of you. Mm-hmm. And you also never really know yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think the mystery is what keeps us going. But at the same time, we're destroying the mystery. So, you know, I mean, like I said, I don't want to get, it's easy right now to get into environmental issues, how, you know, we make more land available and mm-hmm. how we be able to make more agriculture. But at the same time, we're destroying the land, mm-hmm. you know, the land retreats. But I think what's so interesting, Jimmy, even in the way people look at themselves or the world, the more you make available, the more the world retreats. And when you talk about resonance, I think a picture that's good, I think a good way of exchanging things. And when you talk about beauty, that's where I'm trying to get at. Sorry that I'm making it a bit of a wide curve.
No, it's okay.
It needs to remain a mystery.
Okay.
And I think if people would know what beauty is, the Kardashian would already bought it or post-produce it or put it, you know, like artificially, you know, like, you know, find some surgery on it. Yeah. There is a mystery in it, what it defines.
Did you, with your technical skill, and you're obviously a technically extremely competent photographer and artist, and you talk about connecting people to beauty, could you connect the ordinary man or woman to us as a consumer with the same aesthetic, or is that only a celebrity?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that celebrities are never the most beautiful. You know, I think on a mm-hmm. very basic note, I could tell you that, mm-hmm. like I said, many models in the entertainment industry think there's an obvious extension for them to become actresses or mm-hmm. actors. Mm-hmm. And almost none of them arrive. I mean, they're very mm-hmm. good models. They have an incredible mm-hmm. level of personality in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. And already those are not the most beautiful. They're the most mm-hmm. charismatic. Mm-hmm. But when you shoot actresses, even though they have a certain aesthetic standards to mm-hmm. look as models, mm-hmm. and they're very flattered when you tell them, oh my God, you look like a Victoria's Secret girl. Mm-hmm. You know, like actresses, they got an Oscar. They love the mm-hmm. compliment, mm-hmm. you know?
We all do.
The funny thing is, Jimmy, the contradiction is that just because they do not look like a Victoria's Secret model, they have that level of unavailable connection that we can draw them in that mm-hmm. made them who they are. You know, mm-hmm. a woman like, you know, one of my favorites, for example, take Romy Schneider, mm-hmm. you know. Again, yes, she's a beautiful woman, you know, but there is a sense of mystery and humanity and conflict and that made her so charismatic. Mm-hmm. And if you're a model and you go into a movie, you know, and you're going to be in a movie, sorry, you probably get killed in the first scene because you're not really reflecting anything charismatic. You don't mm-hmm. tell story. Mm-hmm. What people in the end are interested in is not beauty. It's the story that connects you to that beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the one last question is, and I'm always asked this as well, and I always find it fascinating to ask other people, when you die, which we will do without being in any way morbid, hopefully not for a long time yet.
That's a good
question. How would you? Yeah, because it's fairly relevant at the moment.
It is fairly relevant.
And I ask this to myself every time I go on a journey because the chances are I won't come back, but I'm still here. Touch wood.
That would be one of the questions I was asking you. If you would ever felt like letting the camera go. Did you ever see the movie New World from Terrence Malick.
Yeah, yeah. And I also watched the other night, we watched Fitzcarraldo here in the office, which is also from Werner Herzog, which was insane. Talk about obsession. Insane.
And you have to know the story.
About him. He's amazing. It's amazing, amazing.
But did you ever felt like saying, I don't want to photograph this. I just want to leave it, and I want to be here.
In more recent times, I've often done that, yeah. And it's a very personal process, and you get it happens more often than not. I leave something alone.
Your world. What is drawing you out? Is it because you feel like a lack of?
No, there's a very clear answer to it. Because it's about a balance. Both worlds are relevant. And if you look at life or try and perceive life, I'm going to try and get into metaphors again. It's a seesaw. In Dutch, we call it a wipwap. I think most of us as human beings have the privilege or are lazy or have never been confronted to really have to work hard at the balance. So our feet are standing parallel above the fulcrum of the seesaw. So you have to juggle your backside from left to right to keep balance, but it's not really very hard work.
But does it make you like a traveler between worlds?
Yeah, but
both sides.
Yeah, I'll explain it.
Stranger also in both worlds, because I'm sure when you suddenly complete go on a long trip, you go back to Amsterdam and you have to eat with knife and fork and sit there with a clean shirt.
Complete, but
pretty ridiculous.
There's one place where you're not a stranger. So, for example, the average Joe's feet stand above the fulcrum. I, because of the rather sort of colorful youth, my seesaw broke as a kid. I lost all balance. As a result of that, I now stand with one foot at the furthest ends of the spectrum of the seesaw to achieve that balance. From one extreme in the middle of nowhere in a jungle to the other extreme here in Amsterdam, and I continually jump backwards and forwards. To try and achieve that moment, which is very short-lived, and it lasts about 10 minutes, and it's invariably in the middle of the night on a 13-hour flight to the other end of the world. Everybody's fast asleep. You're sitting on your own in the aircraft. You're standing by the toilet at the back, looking out of the window, and you're looking at the stars. And that is the moment of place and time and acceptance. And that is the continual, that's the place I'm happiest. It's very short, it's very brief, because that's the sort of in the middle of the seesaw, in the middle of the balance of both worlds. You look down, you see the validity of Amsterdam and the developed world, and you see the validity of the underdeveloped world and vice versa. The things that are good are not bad and vice versa.
You know, that reminds me of something. It's a complete different movie. I don't know if you can connect to it at all, but did you ever see The Blade Runner?
Yeah.
If people define themselves as living other people's memories. And that's what they are. And they don't know. It's the memories we have, not our own. And there's this really famous scene that makes me think about what you just said. There's this scene when he dies at the end. And there's the scene where he says, which I think kind of like happens to all of us, and it has a lot to do with photography. And he says, do you know what it's like living in fear? And then he says, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. You know, and I think also we photographers, we seem to suffer with this so much, but always, you know, when I can imagine you or when you talk about this plane, because funny, I have very similar ideas. Sometimes, you know, I go back from Los Angeles and I took these pictures and I'm thinking we've seen things nobody would believe. The person next to us, probably the person that loves you the most, you would never know everything you've seen. And that is also the melancholy of photography. You try to share it with them, you know. And there's an interesting German philosopher that called the system theory. It's related to Habermas. And he says, no, look, like, for example, if you and me, we meet in a cafe in Amsterdam, right? We both build a system. And then your assistant is coming, and then we build a new system, but she cannot be a part of the system of you and me. The system cannot expand. It can be recreated at something else. But so the more people you meet, every time you create new systems, and your whole life is just a kind of like a floating of unconnected, but somehow, you know, but somehow touching systems. But he also says that even, and that's why I'm telling this, even yourself, you are a system that you're unable to share, even with the first person that comes in, because the things you've seen are so unique, and the experience and the emotions you have are so unique. And I think that nobody would ever really understand everything that you thought and go through when you're going on your 13-hour flight.
Using the reference to the philosopher and also in the context and the real realization of us as human beings, and I think the journey we, in our case, in a creative profession, push us on in the struggle, is the realization that it's extremely lonely.
Right.
And we arrive alone and we obviously leave alone. And weirdly, we connect, we see, we experience, as you said, most people have no idea. And no matter how beautiful or how big or how much affirmation is given to the images we hang on the walls of, let's say, Fotografiska, you can never really truly share what it felt like to be in that place. But that, in a weird way, although I find it utterly terrifying when you begin to realize that, is the most beautiful place to be. And that's when you find calm and peace. Because you stop the struggle. You stop looking for that external source of, it's not only gratification, but of acceptance, and go internally and acknowledge it for what it is.
So it's a little bit like trying to stop a moving train, right, from the time that's
rolling over. Yeah.
Did you ever see the movie Basquiat from Julian Schnabel?
No, but I'm a big fan of his other film, Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
I wonder what you think about it. There is a scene where Basquiat, in this movie, has his first show in New York. And I think for all of us artists, it's a very interesting explanation. I've been asked this question often, but how do you feel? And the way Schnabel solved this problem, and I think you can see that he's been through it himself,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, Basquiat's in this room and there's all these people talking, laughing, having champagne and looking at his work. And suddenly, everybody's freezing. Everybody stops moving.
Mm-hmm.
And Basquiat, and the sound is gone. And all the way on his own, he's walking through all these people. And it's such a way of showing how lonely you are when other people look at your work. And he just walks around and then he just leaves the room. And I think often, like, because I think there is so much, like I said, look, I think the most reoccurring word in this conversation really is struggle, mm-hmm. and loneliness,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it really expresses we, you know, it's so hard to be naked on these walls. That's what we are ourselves. You know, we expose so much of ourselves. There is such, like I said, even the physical effort you must make, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's the same. So many times I'm in Los Angeles and then, like, it's all these details that need to come together and then something is not working and you need to improvise, or you having mm-hmm. rain and weather issues. And then suddenly it's there and you know nobody will ever understand. No.
Yeah, talking about other artists, I haven't seen that film by Julian Schnabel, but a friend of mine the other day met Marina Abramović, and I've never met her, and
I photographed her.
I'm a big admirer of her.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said to this friend of mine, she said, from a very early age, I accepted I was always going to be alone. And I made very, very bold decisions never to have a family and to indulge in my art and to again, to gather, to hold that loneliness and accept it. Hence why what she is and makes and says and communicates is so excruciatingly powerful.
Yeah.
Although now at her age and her latter years, and she was sitting with this friend, she burst out in tears. And she said,
"See what she's done at the Modern Art in New York, where she was just sitting at."
Completely. Yeah. I mean, talk about accepting you're alone.
Yeah.
But then she burst out in tears in front of this friend of mine. She said, "You know, but I would love to have had kids, but because I knew I was always going to be alone from such an early age, I made this very, very painful decision that I knew 60 years later I would say this to you.
Uh-huh.
I saw this moment 60 years ago." And I thought, wow, that's powerful. But
incredible woman. Yeah, you know what? I was doing a portrait series, and I was actually in Florence. She had a show in Florence, and I met her there, and I took some portraits of her.
And also that journey in China when they both walk. That, you know, it took 10 years to organize to walk the length of the Great Wall, and then she meets her husband, and he's made the guide pregnant at the end. I mean, what a story!
Yeah.
Oh, but it has to be that story. It couldn't be any other way.
Where do you see yourself in 10 years, Jimmy?
I have a dream, a very big dream. I'm going to share it with you. I don't often share this. I love what I do, but it's very, very physically demanding. I love the physically demanding aspects of it, but I'm now 52. I think I can physically keep up, touch wood, providing I don't get sort of knocked over by a truck tomorrow, which could always happen in Amsterdam on a bike because I drive around without a helmet on.
And because people drive pretty crazy.
Yeah, but I also drive very crazy. So it's also, it's my destiny, my responsibility. And I've now got an e-bike, which goes at 50 kilometers an hour, which is even more deadly. But anyway, I think I can probably hold on with the momentum that I have for another 10 years. Physically and creatively. I have something I want to create for a number of museum installations, but thereafter I hope two things. One, that my project is self-sustaining, so it doesn't need me anymore. And the foundation whereby the images I make generate a substantial income and we can reinvest that in cultural heritage. That's one dream. The second dream is to find, and I'll be truly honest, somebody who, and this is again avoiding the aspect of loneliness, that I truly love and they truly love me, and start an orphanage. Okay. And I want to, the amount of places I've been to and the thrill and the love I'm given by kids who have absolutely nothing, I could see nothing more rewarding than spending the twilight years of my life putting a smile and on their and my face and infusing groups of young children without parents in impoverished situations to see hope and purpose in life.
But so, I think, you know, from both of us, being having the capacity away, because it's true, because, you know, you're not like a guy that can just pick up a camera and take a picture in Amsterdam, you know? And I think it's true. Like, it's in that sense, we both like athletes. At some point, we're not going to be able to, like you say, we're not going to be able to execute our sport on the level
that we aspire. And I don't want to ever become bitter. I don't want to ever become like you described on your previous podcast, looking back at your son. I didn't. Do you have a son, or was it a hypothetical son?
No, it was a hypothetical.
Hypothetical son. You're talking about. Now, okay, keep going. It's worth it. I mean, mine are now in their 20s and give me a lot of lip for telling me I'm a loser and a failure, but that also keeps you very grounded. But talking about your hypothetical son sort of finding an identity on Instagram and usurping you, and the anger, and you reflecting on the journey you had with your own father. I don't want to get into that stage. I want, when my kids, they're now young adults, find their identity and their voice, that I let them fly in that and far take over and beyond, and then I park my creative aspirations, except I've reached, if there is a pinnacle to be reached, there probably isn't, and evolve into giving back what I can. Yeah. And yourself, 10 years?
You know what, Jimmy? I don't even know what I'm doing next Thursday.
Oh, yeah, good answer! Nor do I at the moment either.
You know, I mean, I think we all heard the line, God is laughing at your plans.
Yeah.
And I think also, I mean, the things that happened to me lately, one of them is like one day you wake up, I was in New York, and suddenly they tell me they're going to close down the city. You have to leave today.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, nobody's going to close down New York City.
And they did.
Nobody's going to close down the world. So I think one thing that we saw today, how little ability we have to
control
our lives, and that the best you can do is be prepared, go with the flow, and somehow connect with the moments, what you've been given, and with the privilege.
But I think that's also a very beautiful sort of parallel. And I'm often asked, how do you organize what you do? How do you connect? How do you find these people that you eventually photograph? The honest answer is, prior to each journey, only about 10% I know. 90% is left to serendipity. But the older the older you become, the more you trust. You trust in your senses, you trust in your, if there is an element of intellect and knowledge, and let serendipity take you on her journey. And that's actually very, very beautiful. So that's why I, and I presume you, when everything went into lockdown, I was actually quite relaxed, because I thought, well, this is just another journey. And I've been to some of the weird and wildest, wonderful places externally, so perhaps I now have to go on this internal journey.
Yeah.
So it's all beautiful. Painful,
and
but
think,
all
you know,
beautiful.
And I think what's interesting, because I think, look, we're both so busy doing it.
Mm.
But look, right now we're talking about photography.
It's beautiful. I'm really enjoying this. Thank you. Yeah.
We're talking about this. And it's difficult to talk about it, I think, know, because you have to rationalize it. And, you know, you ask each other this question. And And suddenly it needs to be there. And then you're thinking, is that really my answer to this? You know, but because I think that was really the interesting process. It's so different to, let's say, I wouldn't say intellectualize it, but at least confront yourself verbally, you know, with this procedure that we're going through.
Hey, I'm going to have to... I'm really enjoying this. I've enjoyed it as much.
I think we've done a lot, Jim.
Yeah, and it was great.
An interesting exchange.
Well, you gave me a nice conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope our paths literally cross sometime in the near future. I know we often eat in a restaurant in Ibiza called La Paloma.
Paloma is a great
La Paloma.
You know what? You're talking about the lockdown. I'm missing sitting at Paloma.
I'm missing Muji and Amit. Let's find some time somewhere in the future to meet there and carry on this conversation.
The whole summer, Jimmy. That'll be a pleasure.
The chances are I'll come for a few days.
Yeah, you do incredibly you do really beautiful.
Thank you.
It's important work.
Thank you. Well, I've got a long way to go, but I'm indulging in the struggle.
It's really so keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, and the same to you. And thank you for this really stimulating conversation. And I've written down a number of the philosophers I didn't know about, which I can't wait to indulge in. Thank you for enlightening me.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, cheers. Soon, all right? Hey, big kiss. Bye. 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 Bye.